would your government secretly make a deal to give away its powers to the big corporations? Surely this couldn't happen here in Canada, in British Columbia, in a democracy like ours. That is exactly what has happened, as the business-friendly governments of Gordon Campbell and his counterparts in Alberta negotiated and signed the Trade Investment and Labor Mobility Agreement, commonly known as TILMA. Steve Schreiben, an Ottawa-based lawyer and trade expert, says, "The likely impacts of TILMA represent a profound assault on the capacity of present and future governments in BC and Alberta to serve the public interest." He was hired by the Canadian Union of Public Employees to investigate the deal, which has never been presented to the legislature or brought forward to the public discussion before it was signed. This corporate-friendly trade deal between BC and Alberta came into force on April 1st of this year, and yet few people in either province realize they have been stripped of important rights. As we will hear in today's speech, any company that feels their profit possibilities have been limited by a government law can now sue us all for millions of dollars in damages. If you think your government can make new laws to protect the environment, your housing, or the public welfare, think again. Now TILMA rules, and authors like Murray Dobbin warned this is all part of a larger effort between the NAFTA partners, a kind of new government by and for big business. That's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, or SPP, another non-democratic giveaway of local government power. British Columbians may think they are more progressive than the oil patch conservatives in Alberta, but now we are legally bound to harmonize many of our laws with the lowest common denominator set in Edmonton. If your eyes and ears glaze over any talk of government legislation, wake up to this one, to TILMA. You are going to hear a lot more about it in the coming years, and don't say we didn't warn you. We'd like to thank Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society for this recording. Steve Schreiben is a partner in the legal firm Sack, Goldblatt and Mitchell.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. My name is Kevin Millsap, and I am your MC for the evening. I'm director of an organization called Check Your Head. We do similar kinds of work to the Council of Canadians, but mostly with high school age young people. Oh, thank you. First of all, I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening. This is a very important evening and talk for our community to talk about a relatively unknown agreement, which is the Trade Investment and Labor Mobility Agreement. In short, it is called TILMA. It was signed in secret a year ago between the Campbell and Klein governments, and it is slated to go into effect in just 5 weeks on April 1st. Yes, that is April Fool's Day. This deal extends privileges to corporations and individuals, allowing them to sue provincial governments and provincial government agencies for any regulation that the corporation deems harmful to their investment and their ability to make a profit. There's a dispute resolution process within TILMA, which is similar to the Chapter 11 process in the North American Free Trade Agreement, or the NAFTA. But the dispute resolution process in TILMA actually goes a bit further than Chapter 11, with provisions for multiple lawsuits that can attack perceived restrictions or impediments to trade. And Stephen's going to talk in more detail about what some of these are. Under the TILMA agreement, even provincial or municipal policies designed to protect the environment and public health are vulnerable to attack from corporate lawsuits. In fact, Gary Marr, who's the cabinet minister in Alberta, who signed the TILMA agreement, said that this dispute resolution process is, quote, everything Canadian business asked for, end quote. Immediately on April 1st, most sectors will be impacted by TILMA, but as municipalities have a 2-year transition period, there are still a lot of opportunities for us to impact our future and the future of the province, which is one of the reasons that Stephen is speaking here tonight. We can talk more about what actions are being planned and what actions may be planned after Stephen's talk, and there's organizing taking place before April 1st, which is when the agreement is set to come into place. For those of you who are unfamiliar with our speaker this evening, Stephen Schreiben is a partner in the law firm of Sack, Goldblatt and Mitchell and practices international trade and public interest law in Ottawa. Stevens practiced environmental law for over 20 years, and before establishing his practice in Ottawa, he served as the executive director of the West Coast Environmental Law Association. Stephen was also very involved in the fight against the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. For the past 14 years, his work is focused on international trade and investment law, a subject about which he has written and spoken and published extensively. He's been retained to provide advice and representation to citizen groups, trade unions, and government with respect to international trade issues as they concern the environment, healthcare, public services, natural resources policy, and intellectual property rights. He currently serves on the board of the Council of Canadians, the Institute of Agricultural and Trade Policy, and as a research associate for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. And he's one of three Canadian members on the International Forum on Globalization. So please join me in welcoming our main speaker, Stephen Schreiber.
It really is wonderful to be back here. I lived here for 3 years from till the year 2000, and I tend to get out of town when governments I don't like get elected, which is why I ended up here from Ontario when Harris was in power. Though it sounds like I'm kind of a cut-and-run kind of fellow, and that's not really true. My favorite public space, this building. It's just this wonderful, marvelous public facility, and I spent lots of time in these basement rooms attending meetings and discussions just like this, and it's also a wonderful community in terms of its commitment to activism and progressive causes, and I just wish I was here to discuss some new great breakthrough in a progressive reform, either to deal with climate change or the incredible disparity and gap between the very wealthy and many of the rest of us, including people who are quite impoverished, and all of the ills and social problems of the world. But no, I'm not here for that purpose. I'm back again to discuss probably the thing I last discussed in this basement, which was another attempt by the neoliberals to establish their regime of privatization and deregulation and free trade as another instrument that will constrain the capacity of governments to do what ostensibly we elect them to do, which is to represent all of us in the public interest. So I'm going to describe, spend a bit of time describing TILMA, though not probably all that much, and then talk a bit about the rationale that they've offered for foisting this regime on you and the people of Alberta, and they're certainly doing their best to encourage other provinces to take it up. And then a little bit about why I think it's really happening and what this agenda is really about. And I'll try to keep my remarks to less than 30 minutes, so there'll be lots of time for us to talk with each other and for questions and answers and comments. So that's the plan. When you talk to people about this new era of global economic constitutions that represent charters of rights for transnational corporations, the first thing people ask, or often ask, is, well, why would a government agree to disempower itself, to remove from itself the tools of governance? Why would any government agree to that? And, you know, I've never really found an entirely satisfactory answer to that question. I mean, in part, they're simply doing the bidding of their corporate sponsors. In part, they subscribe to the ideology, either because the ideology of deregulation and privatization and governments being smaller and doing less, either because they believe in it and take it on themselves, or because they think it's inevitable and that's the way the world is going, and they have no choice but to compete in this new leaner and meaner and harsher world that we live in. But I recently gained a new insight into what the motivation might be when Ontario's Minister of probably International Trade, I think, I'm not sure how the portfolio is described, her name is Sandra Cupatella, visited Alberta and met with the folks there that are very much a part of the TILMA enterprise, and talked about how high the Premier of Ontario was on TILMA, And I thought, that's it. It's drugs. They're high on drugs, and that's why they embrace these new regimes. And obviously, they're bad drugs. And the real question is, if they're taking the bad drugs, why do we get to go on the bad trip? I think that's really, that kind of gave me a whole new kind of insight into, you know, what must be going on and why they would be motivated to sign on to these kind of ridiculous agreements. So before I depress you with the details, let me just telegraph the happy ending, because I think there is one to this. This regime is so absurd, so overreaching, so egregious in its assault on the capacity of governments to govern in the public interest, so absolutely lacking in any rationale or justification, that it won't endure. It won't survive. Other provinces will not join on, and you will be successful, I think, in beating it back, and it will wither and die in British Columbia and Alberta. Those of you who know me, I'm anything but a Pollyanna, so you're not getting my typical kind of take on our future. I just think this one is really just a dead duck, certainly a lame one now, and one that you know, we're going to be able to repeal and rescind. And BC will have just an important part of that. You always have. I mean, I don't think there's any other province in the country that where people are so engaged in these issues and so ready to rally to the cause of beating back the neoliberal agenda than they are in British Columbia. I'm not sure why that's true. It certainly was the case around the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, one of the most, I think, amazing things to observe. And I worked in NGOs and with community groups for an awfully long time. It's just how, and it even amazed me, is just how powerful the kind of grassroots mobilization that took place in this province really was in terms of confronting, you know, a global initiative that really had its home at the OECD. I mean, go figure why people meeting in Comox or Sea Shelter or Victoria could have the impact that they did. But I really do believe that was the case. I mean, maybe Murray Dobbin will write a book about it sometime and kind of explain how, you know, from the very from the basements of churches and rooms like this, community groups can have such an influence internationally over an agenda that's backed by such powerful and influential forces. The other thing I just want to say before getting into the nuts and bolts of TILMA is just that it's a bit ironical to be standing here when the real experts in this new endeavor are in your community, and Ellen Gould in particular, who you know, sounded the alarm and has been sounding the alarm about TILMA virtually ever since it was signed a year ago. It took her a while to get my attention and the attention of others. And it's really kind of remarkable that this thing has gotten so far without there being more hue and cry about it. But that's certainly happening now, and she and her partner, Marie Dobbin, have an awful lot of, should get a lot of credit for that. And then, of course, there's the CCPA, and Mark Lee, who may or may not be here this evening, I think he may be coming, who with Aaron Weir, who works for the CLC, have done a really wonderful critique of the work that the Conference Board of Canada has done. That's one of the things that's a bit kind of formidable about the forces behind this, is that the Conference Board of Canada is so committed to promoting it. But they've done a wonderful job of dissecting you know, this ludicrous rationale that the Conference Board has offered for this project. So those are the people that we should all tip our hats to in terms of making us aware of the fact that this is happening and helping us to understand just how serious the assault is and how important it is that we rally to respond to it. Here's TILMA. The essential elements, and really there are only two. There's lots of complexity when you get into the exceptions, but there are really two essential features of the regime that really matter. The first one is the prohibition against any form of government activity or regulation or conduct or practice or program. There's an article in TILMA that says, government shall not, I can't remember the precise word, it is, establish or maintain, but in any event, measures, the term is measures, which means in trade speak, anything that government does, and governments do everything from provide services to regulate corporate activity in the public interest and fund programs, and anything that governments do is a measure. So no government shall maintain a measure that restricts or impairs trade, investment, or labor mobility. So that's the key operative thesis of the regime. So just stop and think about that for a moment. Is there anything that a government does that you can think of that doesn't impair trade, investment, and labor mobility? I can't think, it's an honest question, I can't think of anything that a government does. I mean, anytime a government provides a service, for example, healthcare insurance, it impairs the opportunity of a private investment or insurance company to provide private insurance every time it imposes a height restriction or a land use planning constraint and impairs or restricts the ability of investors to do what they want with their property. And any time it passes an environmental regulation, every time it funds a social program that's delivered on a not-for-profit basis, it impairs the ability and profitability of investors who want to access those funds, but are preside over for-profit corporations. So there really just isn't anything that I can think of that governments do that doesn't defend that broad prohibition. So the first thing you have to disabuse yourself of is the notion, and I'll speak more about this, that this has anything to do with trade. It really doesn't. It only has to do with regulation and the role that governments play in society, and its only project is to dismantle and limit and reduce and diminish the role of the state to govern in the public interest. So that's what it's basically about. Somebody asked me the other day about they were trying to get the lawyers for a municipality, which will go unnamed, to do some work on TILMA and explain to the members of municipal council what it might mean for municipal governments. And TILMA applies to not just the provincial government and municipal governments, but every institution that has a public character or that is publicly funded, including, and they're explicit about this, school boards, but it would include the Children's Aid Society, certainly a library, any public institution or mechanism of the state is caught by this regime. So somebody asked, well, what does this mean for municipalities, and what can we give the lawyers for the municipalities some examples of what might be harmed in terms of the capacity of the members of council to represent their constituents? And I said, well, no, the better question would be to ask the lawyers whether there was anything that the municipal government does that couldn't be challenged under TILM. And I think that really is the question. There's an answer to the question. The answer is yes, there are some things because the broad prohibition is the overlay, but underneath it are a number of exceptions. So there are some exceptions for water, which are probably meaningful in terms of which would apply to regulations that protect water quality or perhaps even stream habitat or water services. So there are some things that are carved out from this regime. But even with respect to the carve-outs, the general premise is that they will wither and reduce and diminish. And that, too, is written into the agreement. So you can have an exception, but the exceptions have to be reviewed. Ellen's more familiar with some of the details, but they have to be reviewed either annually or periodically with a view to reducing the fact that there is anything out there that is protected from the basic premise and assault of this regime on reducing the role and capacity of government. So that's the first and major feature of TILMA. And it goes far further than NAFTA, far further than any of the agreements of the WTO. But those agreements are constrained, I mean, as broad as they are, they're still constrained in terms of their ambit and application. For example, under NAFTA, investors' rights are protected only from discriminatory government measures, though the tribunals tend to read that very broadly, and from activities of governments that expropriate private investment, and there are some rules about performance requirements. But there's a limited list of rules. It's compared with NAFTA, TILMA simply says you can't do anything at all. No matter how inconsequential the impact, it cannot restrict or impair the rights of investors, or trade, or labor mobility. So it's just far broader in its reach and application than anything that they've been able to formulate as an international discipline on the capacity of governments to do what we elect them to do. So that's the first thing you need to know about TILMA, and one of the reasons I think it's so vulnerable. The second is that, and Kevin already mentioned this, but what really matters about these regimes is how powerful the enforcement mechanisms are that are built into them. That's why we have a very robust kind of sphere of international human rights law, and there are lots of conventions that the International Labour Organization, the ILO, has formulated and passed, and why we have international treaties about biodiversity and climate change that don't mean anything. Because they can't be enforced, they don't have meaningful enforcement mechanisms. There are some exceptions to that. The Montreal Protocol on ozone-depleting substances has a credible enforcement mechanism, but it's easy enough to write agreements, and governments are happy to do that and to sign on to them, but often they don't mean very much. And what you need to know is whether there's a credible and meaningful compliance mechanism built into the agreement that will compel governments to comply with the requirements of the instrument. And TILMA has incorporated the most formidable and pernicious mechanism of that kind. It's the one that resides in Chapter 11 of NAFTA and thousands now of bilateral investment treaties. And that is the right of private parties to enforce these treaties and to claim damages where governments fail to comply with constraints the regime imposes. That is the most powerful enforcement mechanism yet devised, and in fact difficult to imagine anything more influential, to enforce an international agreement. What's, you know, really preposterous about that, of course, is that, you know, investors and the private interests that can invoke these treaties, of course, aren't parties to the agreements and don't have any obligations under them. They only have rights and no responsibilities, and yet they can still, in this case, enforce an interprovincial agreement. This is an agreement between provinces, and yet private interests can enforce it.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to a speech by lawyer Stephen Schreibman on TILMA, the Alberta-BC Trade, Investment, and Labour Mobility Agreement. This secret deal will help big business and corporations limit what your government can do for the public good. Here is Stephen Schreibman.
So let me kind of describe what that enforcement mechanism is like and how it plays out. We know a fair bit about this because we've watched it be deployed in the form of the investor state suit provisions of NAFTA. So, and what I'm not having lived here for the last 6 years, I'm not that familiar with the stuff that's topical in terms of, you know, government policy and law, but I gather, you know, air quality is, and the province has talked about improving air quality. I remember it being a problem in the Lower Mainland when I lived here, from the number of cars on the streets compared to 6 years ago, I suspect it's as much or more of a problem. And the province, I think, has talked about tailpipe controls or emission controls. Let's assume that they might have talked about that and actually been sincere about doing something about it. So this is obviously, if you're certainly the producer of a vehicle that's subject to these regulations, a constraint on your ability to sell vehicles that don't comply with the standard, and they may be less expensive to manufacture. And so if you can claim some status as a corporation with some existence in Alberta, and you're unhappy about this BC initiative, and give you a healthcare example too, if you'd like, though British Columbia, unfortunately, is the exporter of privatization when it comes to healthcare, not the importer. But you go to, if you're in Alberta, you go to the Alberta government and you say, look, we're not very happy about what BC is planning in terms of new environmental regulations. We'd like you to invoke the fact, you know, the TILMA provisions that allow you to go to your counterpart in BC and say, look, we have to talk about these regulations. We don't think they're a very good idea. If the government doesn't take up your complaint, I think it's in 21 days, you're entitled. Now, just think about that. There's no constraint on the number of complaints that could be brought forward. So virtually anything that governments do that businesses don't like, they can challenge under this regime. And it's easy enough for businesses that have some corporate existence or friends in the other province to simply get their friends or some subsidiary or their own corporate entity itself to go to the other government. In this case, I'm using Alberta as an example, and say you have to invoke consultations under TILMA. 21 days later, so there might be hundreds of complaints, thousands of complaints, the lawyers are going to have a field day with this. And so suddenly government's inundated with these complaints. If it doesn't respond in 21 days, then you, the private investor, for example, is entitled to write to the BC contact person and say, well, we want to consult with you about this measure. We don't think you should proceed with it. If the government in BC doesn't see it your way in 30 days, you're entitled to invoke a formal dispute resolution under TILMA. And have a panel established to hear your complaint about the way the agreement is written, about the interpretation of the agreement. So you interpret the agreement as saying you can't regulate in this way because it's going to interfere with our investment rights, and you may not agree, but we're entitled to have that matter resolved by a panel, by an arbitral panel. So the panel's established. There's some very tight time constraints that for doing that as well. And it and it's comprised of people that are nominated to a roster by the two parties, and there's a process for choosing the members of the panel. The panel operates under something called the UNCITRAL arbitration rules. They're rules that were formulated for the purposes of resolving international commercial disputes, and they make good sense in that context. So if Sony has a dispute with a company in Canada that's buying its products, and they have an agreement, and there's some disagreement under the agreement, they can go to arbitration under this regime, and the arbitration is a private process. It takes place behind closed doors, basically, and the tribunal can come up with an award, and the award's enforceable in the courts of most nations, because most nations subscribe to the treaties. They're called the New York Convention, and there are some other conventions as well that require that they recognize these international arbitral awards and provide for their enforcement. But that regime, which makes sense for private disputes that don't influence the rest of us, why shouldn't companies, if they have a disagreement, pay for their own dispute resolution? We'd like that to make sense for that to happen, are now being used to resolve disputes that aren't private at all. They're not commercial at all. They're disputes between private interests and the state, not over commercial arrangements, contractual arrangements, but over what governments do in the public interest, duly enacted measures established in good faith to serve the community's interests. That's what's being debated in these arbitral regimes that were established for another purpose entirely. And so the norms of that arbitral regime are very secretive and closed and don't admit of the participatory rights of third parties. And now the TILMA authors have done something to address that and have required some measure of transparency about the dispute resolution processes, but they haven't gone very far. But anyway, going back to our case, the panel's established, and some environmental groups in Alberta and British Columbia decide they want to intervene in the case because, after all, they worked for years to persuade the province of British Columbia to do these things, and now suddenly, as soon as they're about to happen, and they don't need to have happened yet, or they just have happened, they're now being attacked under this regime that nobody heard of before. And so they go knocking on the door of the tribunal, and the tribunal will tell them, as it told the postal workers and the Council of Canadians in a challenge to Canada Post and Canadian Postal service policy. In the UPS case, and I represent those organizations, that under antitrial rules, there is no authority in the tribunal to admit the participation of third parties, no matter how affected their interests may be. If the panel acts in the same way that investor state tribunals have under NAFTA, and I think that's a correct reading of antitrial rules, that they simply don't contemplate the interests of third parties to provide for them. The tribunals have stretched that envelope a little to say, as they did to us, well, you can file an amicus brief with us. You can't see the evidence because UPS is claiming that it's confidential, and the investor in Alberta will make the same claim. And you can't participate in the process, and you can't introduce any evidence on your own, and you certainly can't cross-examine the parties in the dispute. But you can send us a brief if you like, as long as it's not more than 20 pages. And we're talking about cases that involve, you know, sophisticated litigation and lots of material. So that's the extent of third-party participatory rights under the system. Okay, so the tribunal decides that, you know, the investment, this air quality measure in BC actually is going to impair the ability of, say, somebody who makes an appliance or a device or a vehicle that wouldn't meet the standards to actually sell their products in British Columbia. And the measure has to go. I think British Columbia then has 30 days to address the problem, perhaps rescind, or it's a municipal measure, or it's something that the Children's Aid Society has done, or a public hospital has done in terms of not providing access to the hospital for somebody that wants to put a private MRI in the institution. And some of this stuff has happened in British Columbia from my reading of emails. So anything like that, you have 30 days to get your act in order and make sure that you've complied with the dictates of this private tribunal. And if you don't, we go on to phase two of the arbitral process. And phase two is about damages. Okay, so you've found this measure has been non-compliant. BC has refused to remove it. I want damages. And so the tribunal is authorized to give you damages. The authors of TILMA have imposed an upper limit on that. It doesn't exist under NAFTA. You can only collect $5 million, but you can collect $5 million for every single government measure that offends TILMA constraints. So I did a case study of this. I've written an opinion, a legal opinion about this for the Ontario Federation of Labour, which describes the framework and gets into some detail around labour mobility. And I'm doing another one, or have done another one for QB, which looks at public services. And one of the examples, or the two examples I look at in public services, is the Chiaulli case, which you probably know about. Do you know about the Chiaulli case, which was an assault on Medicare, came from Quebec, the Supreme Court of Canada decided by a narrow majority about 2 years ago, which found that Quebec's ban on private insurance for insured healthcare services, the services that we get through the publicly funded insurance systems that are in place in every province, offended Mr. Chiaulli's charter rights under Section 7, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, because the waiting lines for this hip surgery he wanted were too long. And in deciding that, Supreme Court of Canada found that the only people in Canada that are entitled to health care are people that can afford to purchase it. That's my short form of the case. That actually is what the court decided, because it absolutely rejected the notion that the Canadian government owed Canadians any obligation to provide any measure of health care. But what they couldn't do was interfere with the rights of private parties to purchase health care. It wasn't being provided in timely in the public system. Anyway, it took Chiaulli 10 years to get there. You know, he had to bring the case before the Quebec Superior Court. He lost. He had to go to the Court of Appeal. That took another 2 or 3 years. He lost there, too. Every Quebec judge thought this was a ridiculous idea, his claim. And then a few more years to get to the Supreme Court of Canada, and then by a 4-3 margin, because only 7 of the judges were sitting, he prevailed. He didn't get damages at the end of the day. Under TILMA, he could make the same complaint, but he would have a much easier task ahead of him, because he wouldn't have to establish that anybody's charter rights were offended. He would only have to establish that a ban on private insurance interfered with investor rights. Well, that would take all of about a minute because it's obvious on its face that a measure like that does that. And then you're into, you know, how quickly can the province get rid of it? And I just gave you the time constraints, 21 days, 30 days, another 30 days. I mean, it might take a year. But the challenge of establishing his case and then the time for asserting it and having it resolved would be a fraction of the time invested by Chowley in going out with his attack on Medicare. And at the end of the day, he walks away victorious with at least partially victorious with the Supreme Court of Canada judgment. And but he doesn't walk away with any cash. Well, under Kilmer, there's money involved as well, so it's a great incentive to formulate the claims. So I've got 5 minutes, so I'm going to go on. Those are the two key things you need to know about Kilmer. Government shall not do anything. And two, if you do, we're going to come and get you and get money in the process. And so we can talk about that if you have questions. The things I just want to do briefly are, so the rationale for this, where does it come from? It comes from these Conference Board of Canada reports, and you have to, if Mark isn't here, if he can say something about this, but there's these wonderful critiques that the CCPA has done. I mean, to say that it's a house of cards, the Conference Board of Canada analysis, is really being generous and kind to it. But really, you have to have some sympathy for their task, because they have to persuade Canadians somehow that there actually are barriers to trade, investment, and labor mobility in the country. So you really have to suspend this belief to get there, because when was the last time you were stopped at a border station between BC and Alberta? Or when was the last time you had to pay a tariff when you wanted to get a good from Manitoba or Ontario? Or when was the last time you had to use a passport in order to fly to Toronto? Or we live in a free country. There simply aren't any meaningful barriers to trade, investment, and labor mobility. What there is, are a number of differences in a federal state and the way the provinces go about doing things like providing services. They do a great job of providing healthcare services in Quebec. We don't do as good a job in the rest of Canada. Some provinces do a much better job of environmental regulation, and the political and economic and social circumstances of provinces vary, and the extent to which and the manner in which governments represent their constituents varies from place to place. That's the inevitable feature of a federal state. So those are differences that do exist, and very occasionally, they may interfere with somebody's trade, investment, and labor mobility rights. So if you're a teacher in Alberta and you've got 4 years' worth of training, I gather it's not so easy for you to get a certificate in British Columbia if you need five. Quebec, the only trade barrier I'm aware of in the country, Quebec doesn't like people because it's selling margarine of a certain color in Quebec. I mean, so we need Tilma to deal with this problem, obviously. And so, you know, I have some sympathy for the Conference Board of Canada having to persuade people there actually is a problem out there that needs to be addressed, let alone with the canons that this thing offers as a trained on governments of every character, of every size, and every public institution of the land. So that's their rationale. Now, what I think is really going on is that, and you already have some of this in my introductory remarks, but this is really just the neoliberal agenda again. And they've had great success in writing these rules as supranational constitutions that really constrain everything that governments do. So it's no longer really as important for you as a government to say, well, can I establish this measure? Can I deliver this public services in a way that complies with the Canadian Charter? It doesn't come up all that often. The real question is, can I do it in a way that complies with NAFTA, or the General Agreement on Trade and Services? Because if I don't, there's a powerful enforcement regime that someone's going to invoke that's going to mean a lot of time and aggravation and potentially money for my government in defending my measure. These are the new constitutions, really, that exist and supersede the sovereign and democratic capacities of the governments we elect. But there's a limit to how effective they are in the Canadian context for two reasons. One is that at a formal level, these agreements don't apply to subnational governments. that was established by the Supreme Court of Canada in 1930 when Canada negotiated or joined a labor convention about minimum wages and basic minimum standards of labor rights and tried to establish them as national standards. And the Supreme Court of Canada said, no, no, you don't. We live in a federal state, and those are provincial matters of jurisdiction. You can negotiate these agreements, and you're bound by them internationally, but you can't implement them domestically. So the neoliberals have always been looking for a mechanism to impose as a formal, legally binding requirement on the provinces the obligations that Canada has taken on under NAFTA and WTO. Now, at a practical level, provinces do comply, because they have to comply, because they subscribe to the same general principles, and they believe that their economy is dependent upon Canada observing its international obligations. So rarely do they kind of balk when the federal bureaucrats come to the provincial bureaucrats to say, no, you can't do that because some trade rule prevents governments from doing that. But as a formally legal binding requirement, it doesn't exist, and the Constitution stands in the way. So how do you get around it? You get around it. The first step they took in this direction was to negotiate something called the Agreement on Internal Trade, which is an interprovincial agreement that imposes these same disciplines, these same neoliberal disciplines that are written into trade agreements on provinces. Okay, well, good. That was an important step in the right direction, the corporate sponsors of this project say. But you're not enforcing it very vigorously. We know, and really the reason for that is no matter how right-wing or how corporatist a government is, there's still some things it won't do. I mean, this is true internationally as well. You know, so for Alberta to beat up on BC over a health care measure or an air quality measure is a difficult political problem, you know, for governments. I'm just about done now. is a difficult political problem for governments. So how do you deal with it? You know how you deal with it? You depoliticize the process. This is the language that the federal bureaucrats use in. We're challenging NAFTA constitutionally, and we have a leave application outstanding before the Supreme Court of Canada. This is the language they use. You want to depoliticize the process. What that means, basically, is you want to empower private investors who are not going to have any compunction about invoking these regimes to go after governments for not living by these broad constraints. It won't be up to us. It won't be Alberta that challenged BC's measure that people in BC want because they're worried about air quality. It'll be some company. We can't do much about that. So that's the ingenious device that has been seized on to get around the Canadian Constitution, to impose as a matter of binding disciplines on the provinces these rules that corporations have sponsored. And why the corporations do it? Because they're bad, malevolent institutions? Not so much, but because they're institutions that have to grow in terms of revenue and in terms of profits. Otherwise, pension plans won't invest in them. Private investors won't invest in them, and one way to do that is to expand the scope of services that are provided. Often public service providers are in the way, whether it's postal services or healthcare services. Those are investment opportunities that corporations that are bound to grow have to try to pursue and exploit. And every time governments regulate, it's either a nuisance or a diminishment of profit. So even for corporate CEOs that subscribe to the general notions of improved air quality, so they still have a fiduciary obligation. So this is a corporate project. It's just to remove all impediments to growth and profitability. And so written into these trade agreements. And the private enforcement mechanism not only is a way around the Constitution in terms of ensuring provincial compliance, but it performs the same function internationally because among states as well, there's something called the comity of nations. And, you know, there are limits to what the U.S. would do publicly to beat up on Canada around public policy and law. Not that many under a Bush administration, but there would be some. And the private investors, of course, don't have to worry about those strategic, political, and diplomatic problems. So I think that's it, except for the part about us winning, which I think you get some sense of, I mean, from my remarks. It really is an absolutely preposterous project without any justification or rationale whatsoever, really without any. And that's, even if there was a problem out there that could be identified other than Quebec's ban on margarine of a certain color, or certification requirements for various trades and vocations, and we can get into that if you have questions, you wouldn't have Tilma as a response. So it's just not something that can endure. It gets negotiated in secret because everyone's aware of that, that it is the author of these regimes. So they have to get it through and sneak it by before anybody finds out about it because they can't justify it in public. And we're still early enough in the game. The investor rights haven't, in a way, locked in. And so there's still time, and maybe a fair bit of it, to beat it back. But, of course, that won't happen. My presumption is that we'll mobilize around it and that people in this room will become actively engaged in that counter-revolutionary offensive. That's what we get to be, counter-revolutionaries, for those of us who imagined another world years ago. Unfortunately, it's already been taken by the other side. Revolutionary role. And so I'm confident we'll do that, and I'm confident that BC will be kind of an engine of that. And I'm not just saying that because I want to be popular. I do, but I'm saying it because I believe it. Anyway, thank you very much.
You are tuned to the People's Radio Station, CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. We have been listening to a speech by Stephen Schreibman, a lawyer, on Tilma, the Alberta-BC Trade Investment and Labour Mobility Agreement. Writing in the Taii online magazine, Murray Dobbin says, "But Tilma goes far beyond NAFTA, because individuals can demand compensation, up to $5 million per challenge, if a regulation or law merely restricts or impairs an investment. This is an extremely low threshold for a legal challenge. One article in Tilma states outright there shall be, quote, no obstacle to trade, investment, or labor mobility. It could release a flood of litigation. A similar law in Oregon, just dealing with land use, has resulted in over 6,000 claims worth $6 billion. When fully implemented, Tilma would allow legal challenges to the location and size of commercial signs, environmental setbacks for developers, zoning and building height restrictions, pesticide bans, and green space requirements in urban areas. It could also allow challenges to restrictions on private health clinics, halt stricter rules for nursing homes, and almost certainly overturn the current ban on junk food in BC schools. With respect to the environment, regulations regarding air quality are at risk, as are restrictions on tourist developments, the establishment of ecological reserves, the agricultural land reserves, and the authority of the island's trusts. There are exceptions to the agreement and a list of legitimate objectives that governments can try to protect, but even here they have to prove to an independent dispute panel that the objective was met with the least possible restriction to business, a very tough challenge." That's an end of a quote from Murray Dobbin in the Taii. Stephen Schreibman's speech to this trade agreement, Tilma, was given on March 5, 2007. The talk was sponsored by the BC Government and Service Employees Union, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the BC Teachers Federation, the Council of Canadians, and a group called Check Your Head. We'd like to thank Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society for this recording. Find more of their recordings at necessaryvoices.org. Tune in every Tuesday at noon for the local brown bagger here on CFRO, the best of speeches from Vancouver and Canada.